Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour, Season 7. Our goal with this podcast is to help you remember the goodness in life. Remember the goodness inside of you. Remember the goodness inside of everyone else. This world has been so challenging for many years now, and I think we need a reminder that it's going to be okay. We're going to be okay. We can trust ourselves to make it through this challenging life. And this podcast is your reminder. Each and every week, we have a special guest who's going to come here and remind you it's going to be okay. We got this together. Welcome, Bob Serino. We're so happy to have you here today.
Thank you, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Bob, where are you located?
So I'm currently in Pennsylvania in the city of York, which is near the capital of Harrisburg.
Oh, wonderful. I've been to Harrisburg. That's a really interesting area, beautiful area.
Yeah. Interesting is a good word for it.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot going on there. All right. So Bob, tell me about your interest in visiting with us today. What is it that you are so passionate about and wanting to share?
Yeah, well, thanks for the opportunity. I think that yoga is really powerful, and people can experience that when they maybe do a physical yoga practice, like they do a 60-minute something or even 15, and they feel something occurring in their body and in their mind. Mm. And I think that the reason people stick with it is because they're like, this is different. There's something unique about this. And when you delve deep into what is different about it, why does it work the way that it works? And then the implications as it turns it into from like maybe an exercise into a whole lifestyle. Those are fun conversations to have. And when people take on yoga as a whole lifestyle, they learn that there's this incredible body of work that's thousands of years old of people who have dedicated all of their time and efforts into discovering these things so that they can make people's lives better. I'm really interested to have those conversations about, well, what does that look like? Especially as it relates to meditation and living ethically and beautifully.
I love what you've said so far. I think we all remember our first yoga class where many of us went and we had that feeling at the end and thought, wait a minute, what is this? This was not step aerobics. This was not
boxing. It's not jazzercise. Yeah. Well, jazzercise is awesome. Don't get me wrong.
I love it. But what just happened to me? How come I feel this way? And then leaving the yoga class and being a nicer human and smiling a little more and feeling a little more content and listening to your children or your partner. Like, it's so interesting how something like even just asana can have all those dominoes start to fall. And I think you're right. Then we get curious. Like, I remember asking in my first teacher training, like, what is this? What is happening? What is the mechanism? What do you think the mechanism is? Do you have any idea?
When I started doing yoga, well, first of all, I always thought it was a joke. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm not doing that. Are you kidding me? Like, I grew up as an athlete and, you know, I was doing all. And so I was like, if I want exercise, I know how to get exercise. I don't need your yoga. But then I fell in love with meditation, because you enter into a flow state in meditation, similar to what you might get in sports, or I'm a musician also, and I love jazz music and I play bass. So when you play jazz bass, like, or any jazz, you just get into the flow. And so it was really incredible to be able to learn how to cultivate that state outside of an obvious activity like sports, or I also like the longboard. Like, you can just do that through training your mind at any time. And so that was really interesting. And so then when someone said, well, yoga is preparation for meditation, I said, what? I had no idea. I didn't know that these things were related. Mm. So I started doing yoga, asana, yoga with Adrienne, shout out. You know, I think she's helped so many people get into yoga. You know, you just Google, you know, yoga and she comes up. And so, you know, I just started really with like 15, 20 minutes. And then I learned of this really unique approach to yoga that focused more on the subtle elements of the body and especially focused on the connection of mind-body. And so the purpose of it wasn't just to move the body, but the purpose of it was to connect the mind and the body and the breath all together for a really high purpose. So instead of, you know, maybe having a lower motivation, to take your motivation as high as it can go and go into your practice like that, all of a sudden things started to happen inside of me experientially and like emotionally that I did not anticipate. But things like opening my heart and being more patient, all these things that you were saying. And so, Amy, I was like really interested. I said, why does one kind of series of movements have, you know, a good effect, makes me feel good, but a different series of movements is a whole different ball game. It's like, it's not even the same category of experience. And I had to learn more about that because I said, my main goal in life is to be as compassionate as I can be. How far can we cultivate our compassion? I think that's a really cool question. And just by doing these movements with these thoughts and these intentions, the amount of compassion that I could walk around with during the day was substantially different from one series to another. And I said, why is that? And that's how I got into Tibetan yoga. Because Tibetan yoga really looks at the phenomena of the connection. And Indian yoga does this too. Good traditional Hatha yoga, or there's lots of different styles, but they really looked at the body as just one expression of this very complex thing. And they called that the Panchakosha system, or the five layers, the five coverings. And so if our mind is this mental thing and we experience the world that way, but mental things can't be physical things. Like, I can't put my thought in a jar. It's not a physical thing. And my physical parts are not my mental parts, you know, because they're physical. They're not mental. I can hold it in my hand. But the two are obviously connected. So how does that work? And then how does that then come into this experience of patience, kindness, love, wisdom, compassion? Like, how do these things relate? And so the tradition that I learned in the Tibetan lineages was about how there's subtle energy in our body, which I have a science background. And I thought that was super weird and woo-woo. But as a scientist, I said, I'm beholden to test. You know, I'm not just going to write it off because I don't understand it. If people have been really passionate about this for thousands of years, I should at least check it out. And so because I had a good teacher who was helping me guide me through that experience, I started to have very direct experiences of this energy that's subtle. And so what I learned through my teachers is that there's a connection between our mind and this subtle energy in our body. That's where the mental world and the physical world, that's where they touch. Not that they're the same thing, but they can influence each other. And so the traditional representation is a horse and a horse rider. And so the horse rider is like your mind, because with your intellect and your discernment and your wisdom, you can pull the reins, right? But then the horse is like the prana or the chi or this subtle energy in your body. And so the two go together as one, which in Tibetan is lung sem jukpa chikpa. Lung means energy, sem means mind. Jukpa means to come together, chikpa as one. Whoa. So the prana in our body and our mind come together as one. So all of a sudden, you can start to influence your mind through your body, and you can influence your body through your mind. And if you do that together as one, you join those together, yoga, then you're able to be much more the author of your experience as opposed to the victim of your experience, so to speak.
I just love what you've said, and it really lines up with modern neuroscience around the vagus nerve, and that 80% of the signals are coming from the body to the brain, only 20% right. from the brain to the body. So here we've done all of this top-down processing and psychology, and not that I'm against any of that, but how cool that we can use our bodies to influence our nervous system, our brain, and ultimately our mind. That is so cool.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I love about, there's this one presentation in the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, which is written in like the 15th century, that one of the, considered the defining texts on Hatha Yoga. They said that, to paraphrase, if you can't control the mind, then move the wind. And wind means like prana or energy. So you can move your body to move your breath, and then the breath influences the prana, and then the prana influences the mind. So if you're like, okay, I know that meditation's good, And I'm having like an affliction right now, like I'm upset or whatever. And so I sit down and meditate and I just can't. You know, I'm trying to have constructive thoughts and I just can't. My teacher teaches it as the idea of like, if you got a clog in your pipes and you're real upset about it, there's two things that you should do. Number one is you clean it from the inside. And that's the idea of like cleaning your mind. So you jam a stick, you know, or put some Drano down or whatever. But the other thing is you bang on the pipes from the outside. And so that's where movement practices are really, really helpful. If the mind is unruly, then try to tame the winds through the body and through the breath. And then you'll find that you can gain a lot more control over your experience of your mind.
I just love what you're saying. It's so amazing. Thank you for really explaining it so clearly.
I'm grateful to my teachers. With the vagus nerve, you know, even if you just do Ujjayi breath, right, which is like where you close the glottis and you have like the Darth Vader voice or like the ocean breath, like, ah. So if you have a good practice of that, and even without movement, what that does is it immediately starts to change. It shifts your nervous system functioning from fight or flight to, you know, rest and digest. And a buddy of mine was saying that if you have an identity structure that's harmful or destructive or something that's not helpful, yoga is very much about becoming aware of those and then shifting those from destructive to constructive. When you're in fight or flight, when you're, you know, in total states of stress, your identity structure is very solid because you don't have the luxury of reprogramming. It's like, I got to run the program. I have to respond to the world right now. There's no time, you know? And so if you're trying to change your mental habits to be something more beautiful, graceful, and kind, but your nervous system doesn't allow you to even get to that point, doing something as simple as an Ujjayi breathing exercise, let alone bringing that into your asana practice, into your movement practice, where you're very much in this beautiful flowing state of breath, total control, long and fine, then you're able to create the physical conditions in your body, which is, as you said, corroborated by modern psychology and modern neuroscience, but you're creating the biological conditions in your body for a mental evolution to occur. Because if your biology is in a state of survival, then it's really difficult to change the software if the hardware is all crazy. And then if you want to do a spiritual evolution, then you got to bring every single part of you to the table in a state of non-attachment and plasticity so that you can change it.
You know, Bob, I love everything you're saying. You are singing to the choir right now, and all of our listeners are just glowing at this moment. And before we got on the call, I was thinking to myself, is yoga, is meditation, is that for people who have the privilege to go and spend the time doing that? They maybe, for whatever reason, have a lot of money. They don't have to work 10 hours a day. They don't have to commute. Like, is this only for the privileged? And on one hand, I can see that, yeah, if you have all that privilege, you have a lot more space to study all of this. But what you just said, and I'd love to hear your perspective when I finish. Actually, something as simple as Ujjayi breathing levels the playing field. What do you think?
You know, I think that yoga is where there's a teacher who's teaching yoga, and I think the privilege is access to wisdom. And oftentimes, but this is by no means the rule at all, but it is a common thing is that when we think of people who maybe don't have access to privileges that others may, there aren't teachers there necessarily. But also, there are. Like one of my dearest friends who did a 3-year, 3-month, and 3-day silent retreat, he learned yoga in jail. And now he's like just one of the most amazing yogis that knows the lineage, you know, he knows the text. And so you would think that those people oftentimes are categorized as people who are underprivileged because, well, you're in jail, but wisdom can be there too. And so I think that the privilege is the context. If someone has the privilege of having access to the wisdom and having access to the practice. But as far as the practice itself is concerned, you know, when people ask me, what is yoga? I think yoga, more than anything, is living an ethical life. You know, Master Patanjali, who wrote the defining text of yoga, the Yoga Sutra, He gives us three modalities or three methodologies of how to practice yoga. And this is written, there's debate about it, but you know, somewhere around 200 AD, plus or minus, long time ago. Okay, so the defining text on yoga of the school of yoga as a philosophical school of India, he said, listen, there's all these great things that are going to happen. I'm going to give you three options of how to do it. The first is Abhyasa Vairagya. Mm-hmm. Abhyasa means practice or the things that bring you up. And Vairagya means splitting yourself from things that bring you down or renunciation or giving up the causes of suffering. So taking up the causes of the liberation of suffering and giving up the causes of suffering. That's what yoga is. He does that in the 12th verse of the first chapter of the Yoga Sutra in the very, very, very beginning. So mm-hmm. Who can do that? Everybody can do that.
Yeah.
How to do that is, that's the difference of having a teacher. One of the analogies I love is, first of all, we have to realize we're in darkness. Not everybody realizes they're in darkness. And darkness means I suffer and I don't know why. And I want to stop suffering, but you're like, I give up suffering. I'm so sick of suffering. And so that's like being like, oh my gosh, I'm in the dark. And so then some people, they're just like, well, that's just life. And they stop there. But other people are like, there's got to be light, you know, because if there's darkness, there's got to be light. So then what you do is you're in this big room and you're looking for a single light switch. And so you could spend your whole life, you know, like feeling on the walls, looking for a light switch. Or a teacher can take your hand and say, here's the light switch. And so I think that the wisdom is emergent. Like, I think that the wisdom of yoga is just an observation of reality. So therefore, it's accessible by everybody who's willing to take the time to ask the questions, check it out, reflect, you know, just endeavor. But I think that a teacher can be like, okay, here are the things to take up, Abhyasa, and here's the things to give up, Vairagya. Kriya Yoga, it's in the first verse of the second chapter. And Kriya Yoga is defined by Master Patanjali as tapas svadhyaya ishvara pranidhana. And so tapas means do hard things that have spiritual qualities to them. And my teacher teaches the highest version of tapas. People think of tapas as like, oh, I'm going to go stand by a fire and just endure and like, you know, just become disciplined. And that's not wrong, you know, like that is a form of tapas. The way my teacher teaches tapas is not hurting somebody who's hurting you. That's extremely difficult. That's way more difficult than standing in front of a fire sometimes. And so tapas is doing things of spiritual quality that are difficult to do. And so, okay, can anybody do that? Yeah, I think anybody can do that. They just have to know that that's worth doing. And I think that a lot of people can relate to that because they're like, should I do this kind of crappy thing that's easy? Or should I do the nice thing that's maybe a little more difficult? That is a decision of tapas. And that's the first part of Kriya Yoga. Then the second is Svadhyaya, which there's a couple of different translations of that, but it basically means study. So if we go through our life and we're just too busy to pay attention, that we just have no mindfulness, then how could we study what is helping us or hurting us or what's helping others or hurting them? And so study traditionally means study things like the Yoga Sutra or the classic texts. A fun translation is also study of the self, which I think yoga is the science of the self. It's the study of the self. It's exploration of self. And so take the time to be with self and take the time to study things that bring you up, because teachers come in many forms. It's not literally just a teacher in front of you. A teacher could be a book. And then the last one is Ishvara Pranidhana, which there's a lot of translations depending on your school or your lineage. I think that one of the most accessible versions of Ishvara Pranidhana in today's world is surrender to the highest version of yourself. And so who can do that? Anybody can do that, you know? And so what that means is in that moment when you're like, you know, it'd be kind of crappy if I did that, but boy, oh boy, would it be gratifying. You know, like I think everybody has that feeling of the angel versus the devil on their shoulder being like, yeah, do that bad thing versus like, no, come on, man, don't eat another tub of ice cream. You know, it's a bad idea. So Ishvara Pranidhana, in this one interpretation of it that I think is very accessible, is allow yourself to be the best version of yourself, which is a hard thing to do. Tapas.
Hello, are you interested in polyvagal theory? Well, if so, I have two really cool things you might be interested in. One is an app called the Mighty Network, where Marlisa Sullivan and myself are hosting a yoga therapy and polyvagal theory group, and it's free. You can just join the group, come in and share thoughts and ideas on polyvagal theory, yoga, and yoga therapy. We try to post every week, stimulating a community around yoga, the nervous system, and polyvagal theory. So we'd love to have you join us. In addition, we are giving a 7-week class on polyvagal theory and yoga starting in the fall. You can find that on www.polyvagalinstitute.org. O-R-G. So we'd love to invite you to that 7-week course that's starting in September of 2024.
So, Bob, I'm going to just step in here for a moment and summarize what you've said so that when you go to the third thing, we're all on track. So you've said that according to Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, in chapter one is the first way of working with all of this, Abhyasa Vairagyam. What should you do more of? What should you do less of? Then you quoted chapter two, Kriya Yoga, Tapas, choose the good. Study yourself, study your reactions, study your own nervous system. And then in the end, if you want to go with this very secular description, you know, surrender to the highest version of yourself. So that's where we're at. We've got two things. Now you're going to the third.
Yeah. And they all agree, which is really cool. Because right. Like Abhyasa Vairagya, the reason Patanjali does another one is like, all right, if you didn't get it, here's a little more details. So tapas is, again, turning away from things that create suffering and turning towards the things that liberate us from suffering. Yeah. You know, so you can see that each time he gives us methodology is an expansion of a more simplified version.
Right.
So then finally, we get to Ashtanga Yoga, which is, you know, Ashtanga Yoga, according to the School of Yoga, is not a primary series that, you know, that somebody taught. Ashtanga Yoga. Yeah, which is great. You know, it's super helpful. It helped a lot of people. But Ashtanga, Ashta is Sanskrit for eight, comes into English in Akt. Asht becomes Akt. And we see like octagon or octave is eight. And then Anga is like limbs or parts, auxiliaries, or my favorite translation is links, like links in a chain, which I think is extremely instructive. It still captures the idea of like limbs and parts, but it helps us understand the relationship of one to the next. The reason we're talking about this is it a privilege? Is this accessible? And I think that the image of the old time yogi is somebody who had nothing. You know, they were a renunciate who lived in the woods with no possessions or in caves with no possessions. I don't think that that's the ultimate image of a yogi, but I think it's an image of a yogi. And so I think one of the differences is they chose that set of conditions for themselves. People who are not in privilege, 99 times out of 100, or probably an even bigger number, don't choose those sets of conditions. But I think that the basic principles, if someone is able to hear them, I think it's accessible to everybody at some scale. And so then we get to Ashtanga Yoga, which, you know, I won't get into that one because I think, I don't know about your listeners, but I think a lot of people know it. Just in brief, yama niyama, stop hurting people, start helping people, you know, basically stop doing things that are bad, start doing things that are really cool as far as like an ethical way of life. And then physical postures, which actually the definition is more related to a balance between effort and relaxation more than it is actually about postures. That's yoga asana. And then controlling our energy, including our breath, pranayama, pratyahara, which means don't let your senses run wild, like control your senses. So instead of saying more pizza, you know, or like, oh, I want more money, like my senses are just craving. It's saying I am withdrawing those senses so that I can be a master of my senses. Instead of my senses being a master of me, I can start to rein in those wild horses of sense objects. And then finally, because then we're starting to withdraw, then we can drop into a state of meditation where we're keeping our mind on an object with intention to understand its true nature. And then because of the wisdom that we get from that insight of meditation, we realize that the most logical way to live is ethically, and we start over the cycle of the chain, which is the yamas. So that's Ashtanga. So who can do that? I think that everybody can do that. How that is expressed, I think that's where we get into conversations of privilege or not. Because if you think that the only way that you can do your yoga asana is in a downtown studio and it costs a certain amount of money and blah, 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 I think that, yeah, now we get into the realm of who has privilege to do that or not. But I think that everybody has access to deciding how to put their body in space in a way that is constructive and creating a beautiful world and not destructive and creating a world of suffering. I think that's accessible to everybody.
All right. So here's the question. When I read through, you know, our correspondence back and forth prior to the interview, this is the real thing that I want to know from you. So I had gone to Japan a few years ago and I met someone who was an enlightened master. And I put that in air quotes because, you know, who are we to say yes or no? And their perception of reality and of enlightenment was that it actually doesn't have anything to do with an ethical life, that those are human constructs, and that once you get to true, full enlightenment, there are none of these human constructs. And it's not that you might not want to be a nice person and you might not choose to be ethical and kind, but that that inherently has nothing to do with enlightenment. So tell me what you think of that, because I've been struggling with that since this visit to Japan.
I think that's a really fascinating response. And I don't want to say that I understand. I'm not going to say that I know what that teacher was trying to say, because I can't say that I know that. But what my teachers have taught me, here's how I'd interpret that in a way that I would agree with. Again, if this teacher would agree with my explication or my interpretation of what they're saying, I don't know that. But if I were to say, how does that make sense in the way that I understand things, which is incomplete, you know, I don't know, especially considering that tradition that I would assume someone in Japan would be speaking from, is that as soon as you identify with an I, you've lost, like you've lost the game, so to speak. As soon as you think that there is a person doing a thing, then you're in samsara. You've just dropped yourself into avidya, because, you know, the five kleshas, the pancha klesha system of Yoga Sutra is avidya asmita. So avidya is misunderstanding the nature of our world, and asmita is misunderstanding the nature of the self. And so the basic misunderstanding that the school of yoga and the school of Buddhism teaches is the basic misunderstanding is that things are self-existent, meaning there's an objective reality independent of a perceiver, that things exist out there from their own side, regardless of who's looking at it. But we know that's not true, because for me, I'm a son to my mother, but to my wife, I'm not a son. I'm a husband. And so what am I? Well, it depends who's looking. And so where are the qualities coming from? The qualities are not coming from me out so that anybody who perceives me will see the same thing. There's no objective reality to Bob. The perception of Bob is a subjective thing based on who's looking. Another really basic example of this is, Amy, what is this?
That's a black pen, a black ballpoint pen.
Yeah, it's a pen. Most humans would see this and say, oh, that's a pen. But all the humans walk out of the room and now dogs walk in the room. What does a dog see?
A chew toy.
A dog sees a chew toy. A dog's not going to pick up the pen and write their name with it.
Right.
The dog's in the room. Human walks in the room. So now there's a dog and a human looking at the same exact thing on the table. What is that thing on the table? Is it a pen or is it a chew toy?
Right.
Well, it depends who's looking. Well, what is it? Can one thing be two things at the same time? No, that's ridiculous. How could you say that one thing is two things? No, a thing is a thing. That's how you know it's a thing, because it's a thing. And so how can one thing be two things at the same time? And so the Buddha taught about this idea that it's because the thing is empty of its own qualities. That's the nature of reality. And so if the dog walks out and if the human walks out, what's on the table? Is it a pen or is it a chew toy? It gets really hard to talk about, right? It starts to get a little strange. You're like, well, it's empty of any qualities because no one's supplied the quality to it yet. So that's the avidya in Patanjali's pancha klesha system, the five main negative emotions or things that make our face scrunch up, unpleasant things, is avidya, misunderstanding. And then the second is asmita. So now we have to bring that to asmi, comes into English as like I am or I amness, because it was written in Sanskrit, which is the mother tongue of most languages. And so if we're understanding the nature of the pen, meaning that being that is empty of any nature of its own side, from its own side, we are the ones who are supplying that nature to it, then we also need to take that to ourselves. So we think that I exist, but the truth is that I exist only because I am perceiving myself. But if there was no one to perceive I, then there would be no I to exist. Mm-hmm. So the nature of the self is that there is no nature right. of the self. So as soon as you say that I am ethical or I am unethical, then it's a very slippery slope of the misunderstanding of a self-existing I that could, from its own side, be unethical or not. And so an enlightened being would be able to see two versions of reality. Because is it real that there's a pen here? Absolutely, it's real. It's truly my reality. You can't tell me this isn't a pen. Like, that's a very real thing to me. But is it ultimately true? Like, I have my apparent truth, what appears to be true. But just because something appears to be true doesn't mean it's actually true. It doesn't mean that that appearance isn't a true experience.
Right.
That's the entire occupation of being a magician. You try to create an apparent reality that everyone thinks is true, even though actually it's not true. And so an enlightened being would be able to see apparent reality, or what some people would call false reality, and ultimate reality, which is total emptiness, the direct perception of the emptiness of the pen, or the direct perception of the emptiness of the self, and that there's actually no subject perceiving that emptiness. It's just total and complete emptiness. And so for those of us who don't see it that way, you know, like, I can't see that. I can intellectualize it. You know, I can have experiences that are like indicative of that ultimate nature of reality. But for the time being, I'm stuck in Maya. I'm stuck in illusion. I'm stuck in this apparent reality where I think that things come from their own side. And so what we can do is that we can use this apparent reality to get us to the place where we then realize the true nature of reality. And so an enlightened being, according to Tibetan Buddhism, you know, there's four different bodies of an enlightened being. And one of them is what's called a Dharmakaya, which is emptiness itself. But there's three other ways to talk about that being who has just purified themselves of all suffering. So now they have a perfect mind and a perfect body. The way that we get there, though, is you have to ask the question, what makes a pen a pen? And what makes a pen a chew toy to a dog? Why is it that way? So we understand that the mechanism is that it's empty, like an empty movie screen. And then we're projecting an image on it. And that's what gives it its qualities through our apparent reality. But where does the film come from? Where does the image of pen come from in the first place? What the school of yoga teaches is it comes from our past actions, thoughts, and deeds. And so every time we take an action, it's like there's a GoPro on our head recording every single thing that we do. And then the things that we do that are imbued or have the quality of misunderstanding or selfishness or, you know, just misunderstanding of how things work, then when that film comes to project, we're going to see that as suffering. And so that's why we see my yoga practice as something that helped me today. And, you know, yesterday I hurt my neck. It's because in the past I've either taken care of others or I've hurt others. And that's where our ethical conduct is really important, because to realize that there is no self, not as an intellectual thing, but to realize it as a direct perception of the emptiness of the self, or a direct perception of the emptiness of the pen, we have to climb this ladder or ascend this staircase, which is Hatha Yoga. They call Hatha Yoga the staircase to get to Raja Yoga, which is the direct perception of emptiness, to understand the true nature of the self and the true nature of reality. And so it's true that when we get to an enlightened state, we have no misunderstanding left, which means we understand that there is no one to be ethical or unethical, and there's no such thing as ethics or not ethics. The Buddha taught that in the Diamond Cutter Sutra. However, for the rest of us, you know, like, then, you know, we got to work our way to be. I love this one teacher's name, Chula Dasa, Dr. John Yates. He said, insight is an accident. And I love that. You know, if I sit down to have some insight in a meditation, sometimes I'll just get a flash of insight. Whoa, I feel like I just gained some wisdom about the true nature of that thing. You can't will that into existence. And right. So he said, if insight is an accident, then become accident prone. And so is it true that someone can go from total suffering to total enlightenment? Yeah, that could happen. That could totally happen. I don't want to leave that to chance, though. So I'm going to close the gap so that I'm more accident prone. And what happens is, as you do these practices, as you live the ethical life, then the yamas stimulate the niyamas. The niyamas then support your asana practice, and your asana practice supports your pranayama. Your pranayama supports your pratyahara. Your pratyahara supports your dharana, dhyana, samadhi. So each one of these help us get to that place of realizing the true nature of reality. So that's how I would interpret that master's
opinion. I love that answer. That's what I wanted to hear from you. I think it's phenomenal. And would you say that by practicing these eight links that all support one another, that the natural outcome is compassion, unconditional love, kindness, sweetness? I mean, where is that fitting in for those of us that have not had the instantaneous realization that there is nothing? For the rest of us, like, how does a virtuous ethical life emerge out of these eight limbs?
I direct a nonprofit called the Yoga Studies Institute, and we teach the classics of yoga, the classic texts and methods of yoga. And one of the ideas that we've come up with a word to describe, it's not a new idea, and it exists in the Yoga Sutra, but we just felt that we needed to come up with a creative way to really emphasize what we consider to be one of the most essential parts of yoga. We come up with a term called Navanga. So if Ashtanga is the eight links of yoga, Nav means nine. So Navanga is the nine links. So there's a ninth link. And it's in the Yoga Sutra. But again, if you don't have a teacher who can reveal it to you, it's kind of implicit. And so you need someone to draw it out, or you need to have the goodness to be able to see it drawn out for yourself. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to leave that up to chance. So we call it Navanga. Navanga is the ninth limb, is compassionate wisdom. And so it's not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. The ninth is in the eight. So what do we mean when we say compassionate wisdom? There's a really nice definition of it. So wisdom in this sense means understanding emptiness, like we just talked about, that nothing exists from its own side. Life is not coming, for those who are watching the video, a lot of people think that the pen is coming from the pen toward me. So I'm moving my hand from the pen to my face. But reality is that the pen is coming from me to the pen. And so the wisdom is understanding that the world doesn't work like this. The world works like this. Like, if happiness was in money, all you'd have to do is make more money to be more happy. But right. Money has no qualities from its own side. We're the ones who supply our experience of money from our side, or of asana, or of meditation, or of all these things. It's coming from us toward the object, because the object is empty and we fill it with our images. So that's the wisdom. It's understanding, when you plant a seed, you get a fruit. And the only reason you can plant a seed is because there's a space to plant the seed. There's emptiness. So that means that there's the possibility for transformation. Everything is available for transformation because it's empty. And you can transform it through your actions, your thoughts, and your deeds. So what kind of thoughts and actions and deeds should you have? They should be imbued with wisdom. So if you have a misunderstanding that drinking a beer is going to be the source of my happiness, that's a misunderstanding. Celebrating all the times that you've been kind to other people and then dedicating that toward an experience, and understanding that a good experience comes from you being kind to others and serving others, that's wisdom. And then the compassion is, well, why am I doing this? Why am I getting involved with all this? It's for happiness, man. Like, that's the whole point. Happiness, like, people want to be happy. At the end of the day, people do everything that they do because they think, wrongfully or correctly, or wrongly or rightly, that that action will bring them happiness. That's what everybody wants. And so compassion is, in this usage of the word, it's wanting to relieve the suffering of yourself and all sentient beings. Doing everything you can to relieve the suffering of all beings in the universe, which is a really big idea. But a small version of that idea is, I just want life to be good. for everybody, not just me. I want to be nice. I want to be kind because it feels good to do that, really. And I think in everybody's deep heart of hearts, they believe that's true. So if we have this motivation of becoming the best version of ourselves so that we can be of highest service to all beings, that's compassion. We teach that idea of compassion like an engine in a car. So that's the thing that gives you horsepower. And then the precision of the actions is then the wisdom of being like, because you can be compassionate without wisdom and you make a big mess. You know, like I thought I was being nice, but boy, oh boy, was that foolish. You know, like you can still have this beautiful heart, but if you're not wise, it could not end up the way that you want. And then if you have all this wisdom, but you have no motivation, then you're kind of a sitting duck and you're not really helping anybody. The credo of a yogi is to help all beings. You know, so that doesn't mean withdrawing your heart from the world. It's applying your heart to the whole world, which can look like a million, billion different expressions, like a guy in a cave or a gal on a mountaintop, you know, but it could also look like somebody in a suit and tie running a company or a mother taking, like the whole idea of renunciation is giving up all the causes of suffering, which is a radical act of compassion. And in order to understand that, you need to have wisdom. So when you go to do your ethics, how does wisdom and compassion relate to that? It's going to say whether your ethics are actually functional or not, because my ethics might be totally misguided. You know, like what I think is ethical might actually be creating suffering. And so that's not a very good ethical code. You know, so you should check it out. You know, is it actually creating the thing that you really hope it does? And so understanding emptiness and seeds and karma is really important in understanding how ethics work. Because when I don't harm you, then what I'm doing is I'm creating the images of a world where all conflict comes to an end. You know, when I don't steal, which could include time, energy, voices, power, pollution is a great example of stealing from future generations. Then what I'm doing, when I make it a way of life to never steal, then everything that I'll ever need will come to me. Yeah. Because we're in abundance. You know, instead of scarcity, which is the sponsoring energy of stealing, is scarcity. And so the opposite of that is abundance. So then everything that you ever need, which doesn't mean, by the way, you have $1 billion. It just means that you have what you need. Then we get into santosha, which is about being contented with what we have. So how does wisdom and ethics? The ethics are the seeds that help us to have the fruit of insight, where we realize the truth that cause and effect is a thing. So what we do to the world is what we get from the world. So if you don't buy that idea, then you'll just steal and you'll cheat and you'll hurt people thinking that it's going to make your life better. But if you have the seeds to see your projects come to fruition, you know, which includes the project of meditating, the project of doing your practice, actually having the benefits, then you'll realize that it's absolutely ludicrous to think that hurting people will create peace. And so that's how wisdom and compassion are related to living an ethical life, because those are the things that purify the body. Those are the things that purify the mind. And when I say purify, it just means getting rid of the causes of suffering. So that when I see my mind, it's a beautiful thing with beautiful thoughts, and it's concentrated, focused, creative, right? And my body does what I need it to do. And I love my body. When I look at my body, I love my body. Yeah.
I'm just taking that in, Bob. You've done such a beautiful job in explaining these deep, deep teachings to us in such a clear way. And we're coming to a close. If someone wanted to study with you at the Yoga Studies Institute, is there a website? How can we find you?
Yeah. So I'm one of many beautiful, beautiful teachers who are my teachers in the Yoga Studies Institute. So you can find us at yogastudiesinstitute.org. Two of our core teachers completed a 3-year, 3-month, and 3-day silent retreat and have been practicing for at least 3 decades each. They're just really beautiful beings who have a lot to share from direct experience and study. And I try to do my best to share what they've had the kindness to share with me. So if you like this, then what you're hearing is anything good is from my teachers and anything that didn't make sense came from me. So come hang out, yogastudiesinstitute.org. We teach in 8 different languages in 35 different countries. We have an international community of folks who are really interested in learning what yoga is really about, which is really beautiful. And then also in the United States for English language, I interpret what I've learned in another platform called Spiritual Warrior. So you can go to spiritualwarrior.life, and that's me. So that's my effort to interpret some of these classics into different applications, especially for high performing individuals who are either in business or in performance or in art. I love to work with people who are really dedicated to mastery, especially mastery over living fearlessly on purpose. I think that's what a spiritual warrior does, is that they have a sense of purpose, which can be very, very, very elementary, by the way, which is embody love.
Yeah.
You know, but then you have to be a warrior about it because it's really hard to do that sometimes. So we have to train ourselves in the discipline when adversity comes that we are unshakable in our capacity to hold on to what we believe is true and embody that. So that's the endeavor of spiritual warrior as an interpretation of what we teach at Yoga Studies Institute. And yeah, follow me on Instagram, bob.serino. Love to see you there.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'll put in the show notes your Instagram, your website. I'll put in the yogastudies.org website so that people can find you.
Yogastudiesinstitute.org.
Institute.org, yeah. Yes.
And we have yoga teacher trainings and we go through the classics of yoga.
Beautiful. Well, thank you, Bob. It's been so lovely to be with you today. And I'm really, really happy that we got this chance to meet each other and talk about this and share it with the listeners.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity, Amy. You're a very gracious host. And I look forward to our paths crossing again soon.
Thank you to our guest from this week. It is always such a pleasure to go deeply with another human being for an hour and have that recorded to share with the rest of the world. I think it's one of my favorite things that I've ever done. And there are other ways that the Optimal State would like to share with you. One of those opportunities is to meet with me over at the University of Minnesota Bakken Center. We have therapeutic yoga classes multiple times of the year, and they're always in a 4-week series, like 4 weeks for low back and hips, 4 weeks for upper back and neck, 4 weeks for insomnia and anxiety. So we'll put these links into the show notes. And if you'd like to join us online through the University of Minnesota Bakken Center, we'd love to have class with you on a regular basis.
A special thank you to our team here at Optimal State. We are truly a global family. George Mantuan, one of our executive producers. Adam Satchel, senior media producer and sound engineer from the Philippines. Krishna Panchal, a producer from Canada. Modupe Abdullahi, who does the show notes and is an editor for us from Nigeria. And Peter Morley, who wrote and produced the music for this show, who lives in Australia. Find more about Peter's work at www.zenmusic.biz. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.